Image Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, narrated by Charlton Heston. This is tape number one on Friedrich Nietzsche.
God is dead, proclaimed Friedrich Nietzsche over a century ago. This is only one of the many startling claims that made Nietzsche both famous and notorious by the time he died in 1900. Nietzsche may be the most controversial thinker in the entire history of philosophy. He rejects many commonly accepted beliefs and advances disturbing ideas in their place. He also is easily misunderstood. Germany's Nazis later claimed Nietzsche as their philosophical inspiration. This guilt by association made it almost impossible for him to get a fair hearing in the English-speaking world for many years. Even today, for other reasons, he continues to arouse deep suspicion and strong opposition. This is hardly surprising when Nietzsche calls the Jewish and Christian idea of God a lie, utterly unworthy of belief, and denies that each and every human life has unconditional value. He also denounces both democracy and socialism. He disputes the supposedly self-evident truths that we are all created equal, endowed with God-given rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Nietzsche scathingly criticizes conventional morality, saying it's fit only for herd animals. He wants to set aside the moral ideas of good and evil, and to venture beyond them in both thought and action. He celebrates competition and conflict, claiming that we should ignore the suffering they may cause ourselves or others. Nietzsche questions every traditional value, calling for the revaluation of all values in terms of their value for life and for the enhancement of life. And he interprets all life and all value as expressions of a single fundamental drive he calls the will to power. Nietzsche further insists that human beings are basically only a peculiar species of animal. He considers the creative few to be a higher and more valuable type of human being than others, and proclaims the Übermensch, or overman, to be the meaning of the earth. He disputes the claims by modern science, religion, and metaphysics that they reveal the truth about the world and ourselves. Nietzsche esteems art more highly than science and prizes creativity above reason. He even rejects traditional and ordinary concepts of truth and knowledge, claiming that there are no facts, only interpretations. And these are only some of his more radical and unsettling views. It's small wonder that many people find all of this shocking and repelling. Many philosophers have agreed, and the fact that Nietzsche didn't write and argue in traditional philosophical terms has given them yet another reason to pay no serious attention to him. Bertrand Russell, one of the 20th century's most prominent English-speaking philosophers, ridicules him and dismisses him with contempt.
Nietzsche, though a professor, was a literary rather than an academic philosopher. His general outlook remained very similar to that of Wagner in The Ring. Nietzsche's Superman is very like Siegfried, except that he knows Greek. This may seem odd, but that is not my fault. He condemns Christian love because he thinks it is an outcome of fear. It does not occur to Nietzsche as possible that a man should genuinely feel universal love, obviously because he himself feels almost universal hatred and fear, which he would fain disguise as lordly indifference. His noble man, who is himself in his daydreams, is a being wholly devoid of sympathy, ruthless, cunning, cruel, concerned only with his own power. King Lear, on the verge of madness, says, "I will do such things, what they are yet I know not, but they shall be the terror of the earth." This is Nietzsche's philosophy in a nutshell.
Russell's harsh assessment has been shared until recently by many British and American philosophers. But in Europe, Nietzsche has long been regarded as one of the greatest and most important thinkers in modern philosophy. Martin Heidegger, Russell's leading German contemporary, saw Nietzsche as the culmination of the entire history of Western philosophy.
Nietzsche's philosophy is the end of metaphysics.
inasmuch as it reverts to the very commencement of Greek thought, taking up such thought in a way that is peculiar to Nietzsche's philosophy alone. Because Nietzsche's fundamental metaphysical position is the end of metaphysics, it performs the grandest and most profound gathering and accomplishment of all the fundamental positions in Western philosophy since Plato.
In the United States, Russell's low opinion of Nietzsche was challenged and eventually overturned by more sympathetic interpreters led by Princeton professor Walter Kaufman. Kaufman began his classic 1950s study of Nietzsche's thought with this.
Nietzsche, more than any other philosopher of the past 100 years, represents a major historical event. His ideas are of concern not only to the members of one nation or community, nor alone to philosophers, but to people everywhere. And they have had repercussions in recent history and literature, as well as in psychology and religious thought.
Who was Nietzsche, this radical, controversial iconoclast? His brief career ended tragically in 1889 when he suffered a complete physical and mental collapse at the age of only 44. He never recovered, lingering on as a pathetic, insane invalid for another 11 long years, till at last he died in 1900. Nietzsche wrote of himself, "I am dynamite," but even during his most productive period in his early 40s, he was not at all explosive or impressive, either in height or build or in manner. He was a man of modest stature, very reserved, soft-spoken, polite, rather shy, especially with women. In his appearance, he was distinguished only by his enormous walrus mustache and by his piercing eyes. Migraine headaches plagued him throughout his life. He was vigorous and energetic as a young man, but he contracted dysentery and diphtheria during his brief service as an orderly in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. From his mid-twenties onward, his health deteriorated dramatically. He suffered for the rest of his life from a variety of illnesses. Until his health failed, Nietzsche had many close, rewarding personal relationships. As his condition worsened, he couldn't sustain them. In his later years, his few enduring friendships became increasingly troubled. His intense relations with his possessive mother and sister also were more stressful than satisfying. Nietzsche never married, though he hoped to marry on several occasions. He abstained almost completely from sexual activity. It's bitterly ironic that his final physical and mental collapse was probably caused by syphilis. Following his resignation from his professorship at Basel, Nietzsche led a lonely and very simple life. He had no home other than a succession of boarding houses in Switzerland and Italy. He moved about constantly, seeking relief from the illnesses that tormented him. During these years before his collapse, he devoted all the effort he could muster to his work, which obsessed him. The writer Stefan Zweig vividly describes this unfortunate figure.
Carefully, the myopic man sits down to our table. Carefully, the man with the sensitive stomach considers every item on the menu. For every mistake in his diet upsets his sensitive digestion, and every transgression in his nourishment wreaks havoc with his quivering nerves for days. And up again into the small, narrow, modest, coldly furnished room, where innumerable notes, pages, writings, and proofs are piled up on the table, but no flower, no decoration, scarcely a book, and rarely a letter. Back in a corner, a heavy and graceless wooden trunk, his only possession, with the two shirts and the other worn suit. Otherwise, only books and manuscripts, and on a tray, innumerable bottles and jars and potions, against the migraines which often render him all but senseless for hours, against his stomach cramps, against spasmodic vomiting, against the slothful intestines, and above all, the dreadful sedatives against his insomnia. a frightful arsenal of poisons and drugs. Yet the only helpers in the empty silence of this strange room, in which he never rests, except in brief and artificially conquered sleep. Wrapped in his overcoat and a woolen scarf, his fingers freezing, his double glasses pressed close to the paper, his hurried hand writes for hours. Words the dim eyes can hardly decipher. For hours he sits like this and writes until his eyes burn.
It's utterly astonishing that this afflicted man was able to produce such a wealth of brilliant writing during his last dozen years. To do this, he had to overcome his own frailty and suffering and find the strength and determination to redeem himself through creativity. It's no mere coincidence that these qualities are stressed in his writings. Nietzsche knew all too well what he was talking about. Part of his greatness was his ability to turn his adversity to philosophical advantage. Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche was born on October 15, 1844, in a small town in the Prussian province of Saxony. His father died when he was very young, and he was raised in a stifling all-female household which included his sister and his mother, their maternal grandmother, and two aunts. This may partly explain his troubled relations with women in his later bachelor life. It also probably intensified the sexist views he later expressed. When he was only 14, Nietzsche was sent to a famous boarding school that specialized in classical languages and literatures. He distinguished himself there and went on to the universities of Bonn and Leipzig, where his classical studies continued for another 7 years. He performed so brilliantly that the Swiss University of Basel appointed him professor of classical languages and literature at the astonishingly early age of 24, before he'd even earned his doctorate. This was almost unheard of in Europe then. It would be unusual even today. As a young man, Nietzsche was an admirer of the composer Richard Wagner, a frequent visitor to Wagner's home. Although he later became one of Wagner's harshest critics, Nietzsche revered him in this early period of his life, and he celebrated Wagner's operas in several of his first published works. Nietzsche was a talented musician himself. He played the piano very well and composed for one and two pianos, for piano and voice, for orchestra and chorus, and even a sketch of an opera. He abandoned composition in his late 20s, but kept his musical interest throughout his life. Nietzsche remained at Basel for 10 years, from 1869 until 1879. He was then forced by poor health to retire when he was only 35. A mere 10 years of productive life remained to him before his collapse and final illness. But during those 10 years, he wrote most of the works that established his claim to greatness. The topic of Nietzsche's first book, The Birth of Tragedy, was Greek tragedy and related aspects of Greek culture. But his real aim in this book was to explore the possibility that tragic art and culture might be reborn in the modern world. During his student years, he'd been greatly impressed by the thought of the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer convinced him that life and the world are fundamentally harsh and irrational. Yet Nietzsche was repelled by Schopenhauer's darkly pessimistic conclusions and hostility to life. And he was determined to discover some way to avoid them. The Greeks seemed to him to have found a way to affirm life without resorting to belief in God. They expressed it in their art and literature, and it was their alternative to pessimism that he explored in this first book. Even during his Basel years, Nietzsche was not content to be the scholar his colleagues expected. By their standards, he was a great disappointment. His book, The Birth of Tragedy, is now regarded as a classic, but it so outraged the scholars of his day that he became a virtual outcast in the academic community. Yet Nietzsche was undeterred by their attacks. He went on to publish a number of essays and books addressing modern problems and examining human life at both its worst and its best. The first of these books was titled Human, All Too Human. It was followed by others, Daybreak, and joyful knowledge. In these last years, before retiring as a professor at Basel, Nietzsche completed his transition from classical scholar to philosopher. But Nietzsche's next work was no typical philosophical treatise. In 1883, he published the first part of his great literary experiment, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, followed by three more parts written over the next 2 years. This remarkable work expresses his new outlook on life, which he hoped would replace traditional religious and philosophical views and values. He believed that an early religious thinker called Zarathustra, or Zoroaster, had helped originate this whole religious and philosophical tradition. So he chose to have the new Zarathustra announce its demise and replacement. Nietzsche's artistic ability had earlier been expressed musically. Here it found a new literary expression. He later displayed this ability in writing a considerable amount of verse, but he realized that he also had to say more clearly and precisely what he thought about the many philosophical issues that increasingly concerned him. In works like Beyond Good and Evil, On the Genealogy of Morals, Twilight of the Idols, and The Antichrist, Nietzsche addressed these philosophical issues repeatedly. His reflections remain valuable to this day. Few philosophers have been driven more profoundly, and few have felt that more depended on their efforts. Nietzsche believed that our entire civilization faces a grave crisis, for the fundamental ideas that have given meaning to life in the Western world for centuries are collapsing.
The time has come when we have to pay for having been Christians for 2,000 years. We are losing the center of gravity by virtue of which we have lived. We are lost for a while.
Unless something can be done, Nietzsche feared humanity will degenerate and ultimately be doomed. Schopenhauer alarmed him as an early symptom and warning. Schopenhauer was not taken seriously by most of his contemporaries, but Nietzsche saw him as a sign of things to come, unless someone could show another way.
As we thus reject the Christian interpretation and condemn its meaning as counterfeit, Schopenhauer's question immediately comes to us in a terrifying way. Has existence any meaning at all? It will require a few centuries before this question can even be heard completely and in its full depth.
Nietzsche was profoundly anxious about this crisis of meaning and values. He sensed impending disaster. Faint-hearted souls like Schopenhauer may lack the strength to make something of life in this godless, inhuman world, but Nietzsche dreaded the thought that the whole human race might become as weak and hostile to life as Schopenhauer. So he took his stand against him and his dark pessimism.
My instinct went into the opposite direction from Schopenhauer's, toward a justification of life, even at its most terrible, ambiguous, and mendacious. For this I had the formula Dionysian. Schopenhauer was still so much subject to the dominion of Christian values that as soon as the thing in itself was no longer God for him, he had to see it as bad, stupid, and absolutely reprehensible.
In Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche attempted to evoke a new vision of life and its meaning. He presented an image he called the Overman to symbolize creativity incarnate. Zarathustra proclaims,
I teach you the Overman. Man is something that shall be overcome. What have you done to overcome him? You have made your way from worm to man, and much in you is still worm. Once you were apes, and even now, too, man is more ape than any ape. Behold, I teach you the Overman. The Overman is the meaning of the earth. Let your will say, the Overman shall be the meaning of the earth. I beseech you, my brothers, remain faithful to the earth.
Nietzsche was convinced that Schopenhauer, along with most other religious and philosophical thinkers, had gone radically astray. They'd completely missed the meaning of the earth. For Nietzsche, this meaning can be found only in creatively enhancing this life in this world. He sought to convey this basic point with every means at his disposal. He was convinced that unless this new teaching is learned and embraced, the collapse of traditional values will lead to nihilism and desolation. A year before Nietzsche's birth, the Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard wrote vividly about what he thought it would be like if there were no God and no religious faith to sustain us.
If there were no eternal consciousness in man, if at the foundation of all there lay only a wildly seething power, which, writhing with obscure passions, produced everything that is great and everything that is insignificant. If a bottomless void, never satiated, lay hidden beneath all, what then would life be but despair? If such were the case, if the human race passed through the world as the ship goes through the sea, like the wind through the desert, a thoughtless and fruitless activity, how empty then and comfortless life would be.
But for Kierkegaard, a passionate Christian, life is not empty and comfortless, thanks entirely to the God in whom he so fervently believes. God and faith make all the difference. In Kierkegaard's eyes, God endows human life with meaning. God gives every individual an absolute value, and God provides each of us with the possibility of an infinite happiness through faith alone. For Nietzsche, this way of thinking is precisely the great crime of religion, of the Jewish and Christian religions in particular. These religions have taught us to think that without God, this world would be a horrible place and life would not be worth living. Schopenhauer had accepted this radical pessimism because he was unwilling to make what Kierkegaard called the leap of faith. So Nietzsche argues that religious faith, which claims to offer the only alternative to despair, actually sets the stage for despair, as Schopenhauer's example shows. For Schopenhauer, to live in this godless world of meaningless striving is to suffer for no purpose. We're doomed to suffer far more than any possible enjoyment can ever offset. The best possible outcome would be for suffering to cease, but this would only be possible if life itself would somehow disappear. Schopenhauer, therefore, advocates complete asceticism. He would have us extinguish all desire, withdraw from all activity, and reject life as completely as possible. Life, for him, is not simply meaningless, it's an unredeemable evil. Nietzsche abhors this conclusion. He blames it upon the religious tradition that paved the way for it. This tradition has deprived life of all positive meaning and value on its own terms. Religions like Christianity invite Schopenhauer's negative view of life when they make God seem to be the only answer. They've taught us to think that if there is no God, then nothing matters.
Consider the damage all human institutions sustain. If a divine and transcendent higher sphere is postulated that must first sanction these institutions. By then growing accustomed to seeing their value in this sanction, one has reduced their natural dignity, in certain circumstances denied it. The faithfulness of a belief in God is that all actual values were therewith denied and systematically conceived as non-values. Thus, anti-naturalness assumed the throne. With relentless logic, one arrived at the absolute demand to deny nature.
So Nietzsche declares war on the major world religions. He considers them deeply objectionable, above all because they're profoundly harmful to human life.
Hitherto, one has always attacked Christianity, not merely in a modest way, but in the wrong way. As long as one has not felt Christian morality to be a capital crime against life, its defenders have had it all their own way. The question of the mere truth of Christianity, whether in regard to the existence of its God or the historicity of the legend of its origin, is a matter of secondary importance. As long as the question of the value of Christian morality is not considered. Is
Christian morality worth anything? Or is it a shame and disgrace, despite all the holiness of its arts of seduction?
Nietzsche argues that Judaism, Christianity, and other religions have fed upon and encouraged weakness, sickliness, life weariness, and resentment. They've poisoned the wellsprings of strength and vitality. Religions promise salvation, but they actually only obstruct the development and enhancement of human life.
One should never forgive Christianity for having destroyed such men as Pascal. One should never cease from combating just this in Christianity, its will to break precisely the strongest and noblest souls. One should never rest as long as this one thing has not been utterly and completely destroyed, the ideal of man invented by Christianity, its demands upon men. The whole absurd residue of Christian fable, conceptual cobweb spinning and theology does not concern us. It could be 1,000 times more absurd, and we would not lift a finger against it. But we do combat the ideal that appeals to all the cowardices and vanities of wearied souls. And the strongest have their weary hours. What is it we combat in Christianity? That it wants to break the strong. That it wants to discourage their courage, exploit their bad hours and their occasional weariness, convert their proud assurance into unease and distress of conscience. That it knows how to poison and sicken the noble instincts until their strength, their will to power, turns backward against itself, until the strong perish through orgies of self-contempt and self-abuse.
Nietzsche seeks to break the grip of religious ideas and values. He wants to prepare for others a way that will be more truthful and life-affirming. His strategy is to expose the misguided reasons and ulterior motives that gave rise to religious ideas and continue to sustain them.
How many there are who still conclude life could not be endured if there were no God. Therefore, there must be a God. The truth, however, is merely that he who is accustomed to these notions does not desire a life without them, and that these notions may therefore be necessary to him and for his preservation. But what a presumption it is to decree that whatever is necessary for my preservation must actually exist.
Nietzsche regards religious beliefs as common human responses that can be understood and explained in very human terms, but he also intends to make them unacceptable to those who can do without them.
In former times, one sought to prove that there is no God. Today, one indicates how the belief that there is a God could arise, and how this belief acquired its weight and importance. A counterproof that there is no God thereby becomes superfluous. When in former times one had refuted the proofs of the existence of God put forward, there always remained the doubt whether better proofs might not be adduced than those just refuted. In those days, atheists did not know how to make a clean sweep.
Nietzsche attempts just such a clean sweep of the God hypothesis and everything associated with it. He exposes the all-too-human needs, desires, fears, and errors which give rise to the very idea of God, which motivate its embrace. He believes the God hypothesis can be decisively undermined by depriving it of all plausibility. For the faithful, God is the truth, but in reality, God turns out to be only the imaginary product of what Nietzsche calls the vanity, the lust for power, the impatience, the terror, the enraptured and fearful delusion of men. Nietzsche does have some respect for Christianity as a way of life. He associates Jesus with the human possibility of this way of life, which is characterized by freedom from resentment and tranquility in the face of adversity.
The very word Christianity is a misunderstanding. In truth, there was only one Christian, and he died on the cross. Only Christian practice, a life such as he lived, who died on the cross, is Christian. Such a life is still possible today, for certain people, even necessary. Genuine, original Christianity will be possible at all times.
But Nietzsche argues that the religion Christianity became is a perversion of this possibility, deserving a far more harsh assessment.
I condemn Christianity. I raise against the Christian Church the most terrible of all accusations that any accuser ever uttered. It is, to me, the highest of all conceivable corruptions. The Christian Church has left nothing untouched by its corruption. It has turned every value into an unvalue, every truth into a lie, every integrity into a vileness of the soul.
So Nietzsche regards the death of God with hope as well as concern. It's the most important event of our time because it poses both the gravest danger and the greatest promise.
The greatest recent event, that God is dead, that the belief in the Christian God has become unbelievable, is already beginning to cast its first shadows over Europe. But in the main, one may say, the event itself is far too great, too distant, too remote from the multitude's capacity for comprehension, even for the tidings of it to be thought of as having arrived as yet. Much less may one suppose that many people know as yet what this event really means, and how much must collapse now that this faith has been undermined, because it was built upon this faith, propped up by it, grown into it. For example, the whole of our European morality.
The death of God, Nietzsche observes, may be slow. Its full impact may not be felt for some time, even by those who acknowledge it. The habit of religious belief may also linger on among the unenlightened. Religious fervor may even increase with growing anxiety about the consequences of this impending loss. But Nietzsche is convinced that the religious worldview and religious values are on their way out. He warns that their collapse will lead to a crisis of unparalleled magnitude. So he announces what he calls the advent of nihilism.
Nihilism stands at the door. Whence comes this uncanniest of all guests? From the end of Christianity, at the hands of its own morality. The sense of truthfulness, developed highly by Christianity, is nauseated by the falseness and mendaciousness of all Christian interpretations of the world and of history. There is a rebound from God is truth to the fanatical faith, all is false.
The prospect of this nihilism, with its rejection of all previously accepted values, deeply concerns Nietzsche. As a first step towards overcoming this crisis of meaning and value, he attempts to diagnose it.
What does nihilism mean? That the highest values devalue themselves. The aim is lacking. The question, why, finds no answer. Nihilism represents a pathological transitional stage. What is pathological is the tremendous generalization, the inference that there is no meaning at all. A nihilist is a man who judges of the world as it is, that it ought not to be, and of the world as it ought to be, that it does not exist. According to this view, our existence has no meaning. The pathos of in vain is the nihilist's pathos.
Nietzsche seeks to go beyond the nihilism resulting from the collapse of religious and metaphysical ways of thinking, but overcoming nihilism is very difficult because the world is fundamentally irrational and inhuman.
Who are we, anyway? If we simply called ourselves godless, or unbelievers, or perhaps immoralists, we do not believe that this would even come close to designating us. We are all three in such an advanced stage that one can hardly comprehend how we feel at this point. Ours is no longer the bitterness and passion of the person who has torn himself away and still feels compelled to turn his unbelief into a new belief, a purpose, a martyrdom. We have become cold, hard, and tough in the realization that the way of this world is anything but divine. Even by human standards, it is not rational, merciful, or just. We know it well. The world in which we live is ungodly, immoral, inhuman. We have interpreted it far too long in a false and mendacious way, in accordance with the wishes of our reverence, which is to say, according to our needs.
As a cultural event, Nietzsche views the death of God with profound concern, but philosophically it's his point of departure. Everything must now be purged of all traces of the God hypothesis. The very nature of life and the world, our human existence, knowledge, value, and morality, all must be radically reinterpreted.
God is dead. But given the way of men, there may still be caves for thousands of years in which his shadow will be shown. And we still have to vanquish his shadow, too. The total character of the world is in all eternity chaos, in the sense not of a lack of necessity, but of a lack of order, arrangement, form, beauty, wisdom, and whatever other names there are for our aesthetic anthropomorphisms. When will all these shadows of God cease to darken our minds? When will we complete our de-deification of nature? When may we begin to naturalize humanity in terms of a pure, newly discovered, newly redeemed nature?
For Nietzsche, now is the time to rise to these challenges, and this is what he seeks to do through the new kinds of philosophical inquiry he pursues.
This is the end of Side 1. Please fast forward and turn over your cassette.